Thanks. Yeah, thanks for the invitation. It's really nice to be talking to this group about the things I've been thinking about for the last few years related to black hole perturbation theory and sort of symmetries of it from a usual theoretic standpoint. Did a lot of interesting stuff. So here are my collaborators, some paper references. So I usually start this talk with this slide to motivate why this is interesting. I don't think I need to motivate to this group why black holes are interesting. This is a famous Chandrasekhar quote, right? But this is to motivate why I'm really interested in this problem after a lifetime of work in cosmology is that black holes are pure space time. There's no matter sources, there's no stress tensor to their construction. The only thing that's the only elements that are constructed in the Chandrasekhar are the concept of space and time. Understanding how black holes work, you can learn about how gravity works.
So yeah, the point is we're gonna see some mysterious properties of black holes, space times and black hole dynamics, and in particular in four-dimensional general relativity, and those are gonna those hopefully will teach us something about how gravity works. So black holes, I don't need to tell this group again, they're extremely simple, but they're mysterious, right? There's a lot we don't understand about them, but they're now a probe of observational astronomy, right? In a way that they really haven't been before. There's everyone that talks about the new era of gravitational wave astronomy and black hole shadows and all sorts of stuff. So with gravitational waves, we're looking at binary mergers of binary black holes or other compact objects. And the whole process from start to finish probes a pretty wide range of physical phenomena with different techniques to attack them. So this is the standard plot, right? That when you have, say, two black holes, they inspiral initially. So they have a slow period of inspiraling into each other, orbiting each other, and radiating energy and gravitational waves until they finally merge in this highly nonlinear process. And then there's a ring down phase where you have a black hole, a remnant black hole, and it's just ringing down like a bell, radiating off all of the everything that isn't Kerr about it, essentially. Okay, and so there's a lot of different techniques we use. So during the inspiral, perturbation theory, which is what I'm talking about, can apply. There are more sophisticated techniques to probe the inspiral. During the merger, you need numerical relativity, and then during the ring down, again, perturbation theory is key. So I'm going to be focusing on hints of symmetries, both during the inspiral and the ring down phase. Of course, the merger phase, not treated with perturbation theory. The motivation is a couple of mysterious features of black hole perturbation theory and 4D Einstein gravity that both for their own reasons point to potential new symmetries that haven't been accounted for. The first is in the tidal responses, the so-called black hole Love numbers vanished. I'll talk more about what these are, but these are measures of the tidal response from one object on the other. And so for black holes, these responses vanish completely. So they're sort of infinitely rigid in a certain sense. But as I'll discuss in a couple of slides, there's a sense in which the vanishing of the black hole numbers is a kind of a classical fine-tuning problem, because in the effective field theory approach to the inspiral, these Love numbers show up as Wilson coefficients in front of higher derivative operators. And normally, if you have some term that should be there but aren't, you might imagine that there's some symmetry restricting them. So then during the ring down phase, where you're radiating energy in quasi-normal modes, both polarizations of gravitational waves have the same discrete spectrum, quasi-normal mode. So this is called isospectrality. And Chandrasekhar showed in the 70s and 80s that this is due to a duality that lives in the Einstein equation, so another kind of symmetry. So to be honest, actually, initially our motivation was to see if these two things were related. They're not super much, but they're both hints of something happening. And both of these, just to emphasize, they're going to change if you go to higher dimensions. They're going to change if you modify your gravitational dynamics.
So, question: you said that your initial motivation was if there was a relation between zero and
spectrality. Yeah.
So may I ask what was, and I wouldn't have expected it would be a British, British at all, but maybe I'm
wrong. Well, I'll tell you that there is some relation in that. So the isospectrality will also tell you that both sectors have to have the same Love numbers. So it does touch on that in a way we didn't expect. But at first, it was very, very zeroth order type of question. We were all sort of new to this, saying, okay, look, here are a couple of, here's a symmetry, this duality symmetry, can it help us? It can. So I'll talk a little bit about both these. We'll start with the Love numbers. So the idea with the Love numbers, right, is that I have, so this is the inspiral phase. So if I focus on one of the compact objects, then during the inspiral phase, the neighbor, which I can think of as being sort of static, far away tidal deformer, is going to source a tidal field on the central object. In general, when you have a tidal deformation, you're going to have a tidal field, you're going to have some gravitational response, so a deformation response. And those traditionally are encoded in these Love numbers, which were named after a guy named Love in the 1910s. So it was about these Newtonian responses, but as I think was pioneered by Eric and friends, you can also extend that to GR. So it's a static response, so it's for omega equals zero modes principally. It's observable at sort of high post-Newtonian, fifth post-Newtonian order in the inspiral waveform, so it's a target of future observations. And at least sort of if you have, say a neutron star as one of the objects, then it actually is going to probe internal structure, because how a neutron star deforms in response to some fixed tidal source is going to depend on what it's made of, on its state, and so on. Now, the fact that these vanish, as I mentioned, is a bit unusual from this effective field theory point of view. So this point of view, very popular way to deal with the inspiral, is to say, focus on the central object and treat it as a point particle, and then organize the rest of the theory in an expansion of scales. Now, there are various hierarchies of scales you can use. So, sort of in leading order, what you're going to do is you're going to imagine that the black hole is a point, and then any corrections due to having a horizon, due to any kind of size or finite structure, are going to be encoded in these higher order operators. So the leading ones, these are the electric and magnetic part of the Weyl tensor. And then even higher, you'll have derivatives of these and so on. And so the idea is you go out and you measure these coefficients, and that tells you something about the UV theory, the structure of the black hole. Now, as I mentioned, so for black holes in 4D, these Wilson coefficients vanish, which normally is a sign of a fine-tuning, like the cosmological constant problem, right? Or unless there is in fact a symmetry. So this was made, this argument was made, I think, by Raphael Porto a few years ago in this paper, and I think that's what got a lot of us thinking about how unusual it is. These vanish and looking for a symmetry.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Question. So when you start with the Wilson coefficients expansion and EFT expansion, so the zero order is just the mass of the object, right?
Yeah, it's the point particle action.
So are you able in this expansion at order, I guess, subleading to get the angular momentum of the particle? Are you applying this to Schwarzschild?
So this is for Schwarzschild. For Kerr, you have to include the spin. And so, yeah, you're going to have extra terms because you have a spinning point particle. How do you do it? it's a little bit complicated. You have to introduce spin vectors and construct terms that you're allowed to from there. But the point is that stuff is going to be fixed by the fact that I have a point particle, spinning point particles. There are techniques to construct the effective field theory for a point particle spin. And then still these Wilson coefficients are going to be the thing that we're looking at. Any other questions before I move on? Okay. So, very good. So this is a motivation to look for a symmetry, and now I will talk about a symmetry which addresses this. So I'm going to, for the purposes of the Love number symmetry story, I'm going to ignore gravitational dynamics, and I'm going to ignore Kerr, and I'm going to focus on Schwarzschild. Pretty much everything I say is going to apply also to spin two perturbations on Kerr. It's just easier to look at this. And I'll discuss a little bit more throughout how that works. Going back to your question, right? So I'm going to be working with Schwarzschild pretty much throughout, but almost everything I say, except for the duality stuff in the second part, can apply to Kerr also.
Maybe I'll leave a comment here. I always make the same comment when I hear people doing effective field theory giving talks about law number. So there are two kinds of things that people call law number. Okay? So one is this coefficient, Wilson coefficient, right now in this action. Okay. The other thing is what you do in the calculation. You have two solutions and you find that coefficient one solution or something like that.
Yeah. Number. Yeah, it's the next side.
It's not guaranteed that they're the same thing.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
you got to do the matching and check.
Yeah. So the power calculation to guarantee that these are the same thing would require 5 PM, which is not present. Okay. Especially for black holes. So, I mean, if you ask Eric, for example, he would call one of them as a null number, the other one as some either response coefficient, whatever. Okay. So it's, I think it's probably useful to know, like, to be sure that it's two separate things. I mean, it's okay that you do this calculation and you say, I find out normal coefficient is zero. But this does not necessarily mean that this coefficient is zero. That means there's no such terms in the waveform, okay?
Oh, for sure, yeah, though. The waveforms are different.
There is a
piece. But when you produce a Wilson coefficient, did you then do a PM expansion?
So
it's the same coefficient that can't see.
Yeah. So the Wilson coefficient is the one that appears in the waveform. So if you have an atom, that's the one will appear in the waveform. But the log number computed using this method, or is this one, is not necessarily the same one.
Correct. Right.
Anyway, so sorry, I just made the same comment at the time.
Okay. So the standard result is that when you do the EFT matching, it's the same coefficient that you get in front of the decaying term. I'll talk about it on the next slide. You can talk offline if there are complications there. Sure. Good. So I want to start with the spin zero field on Schwarzschild because it's really, really simple. You know, you can do it by hand really easily. So on the Schwarzschild background, you compute box phi, right, the Dell inversion. And this is what it is. I've assumed that there's no phi angular. So this is the Klein-Gordon operator on a Schwarzschild spacetime. And this delta is r squared times the usual blackening factor. And this operator, this wave operator, is separable. So we can separate it in terms of either the I omega t, and then radial modes, and we sum over YLM, spherical harmonics with m equals zero. And then you can find a radial equation, so a single ODE for the radial phi L components, and has this nice simple form. So we'll spend a lot of time playing with this. So now we want to look at static responses. So we're going to set omega to zero. And that gives us this guy here. And so it's a second order ODE for these modes phi of R. And so in general, it has two solutions, two linearly independent solutions. And we can start to understand the behavior of those solutions by looking at their behavior near the two singularities, the two singular points where we're going to want to set our boundary conditions. So near the horizon, there's one solution that's a constant and one that diverges logarithmically. And if we are considering a black hole, we want to impose regularity at the horizon, well, I think divergent. If it's a neutron star, say, then going to have some admixture of these guys determined by matching to the interior solution. For a black hole, you only want to have the regular solution. And then at infinity, which we're thinking of being as in place of the, as sort of the location of the second object, you have solutions that grow. It's the same as the flat space wave equation, basically. So you have solutions growing as r to the l, and decaying as r to the l plus 1. So with the r to the l, this growing mode, we think of as encapsulating the tidal field due to the second object. And then the decaying piece is a static response. And the way you determine the size of the static response is by taking the solution that only has this regular fall off at the horizon. In general, at the other, at infinity, it's going to be some admixture of these two fall offs. And the Love number is the ratio between them. If I pull out an overall factor, the Love number is lambda, is the coefficient in front of the decaying term. So the mysterious feature about the Klein-Gordon equation, static Klein-Gordon equation on Schwarzschild, also applies to the Reggie Wheeler, Zirilli, Tucholsky static equations, is that the solution that's regular at the horizon and the one that's growing at infinity, the solution that's regular at the horizon only gives you a growing piece at infinity, right? Which is not the thing you normally expect with an ODE. You don't expect a single fall off at one singular point to correspond to one fall off at another. It's unless there's something special going on. So there's sort of, you can think of this as a mathematical question, which is why do the ODEs that we get from dynamics on a black hole background have this weird property? And then you could also ask from the physical perspective, why does four-dimensional GR give us differential equations with this unusual property? So the strategy is going to be to find a symmetry of the static Klein-Gordon equation here, a symmetry where, you want to find a symmetry of the action, so an off-shell symmetry, so that you can derive a conserved charges, a Noether current. And the idea would be to have some Noether charge that when I evaluate it near the horizon, and I require that this blowing up solution not be there, that it gives you fixed the value of this charge. And then when I look near infinity, I should see that there's only a growing mode. So to build that symmetry,
I have a question. So how do you say that? Because from the point of view of infinity, you need to have the gain field, right? So whatever it means that somehow the solution, if I look at the analysis of radiation and I'm at infinity, it's not growing.
Good. Yeah. No. This infinity. I mean, infinity here is the.
Right. So all your analysis is really on the near the horizon, because at infinity, what we have is we resum, we have a completely different asymptotic expansion.
Infinity here is really the location of this the companion body.
Of the.
The companion. So I have a binary system. I'm focusing on one, the horizon one. And then I have a faraway companion, and infinity is really, you can think of as the location of the tidal. So it's not like asymptotic infinity where you have a radiation.
Yeah, because that's where if I get the same equation from the Boolean
asymptotic
infinity, I'm
going to
but there has to be a matching between.
You can do that matching. I'm just trying to be as simple as possible, right? So we're imagining just that my space-time goes out to the companion object. And
so then what you have is this growing piece. At some point, you must be decaying to
the right, so the growing piece is the tidal, the gravitational field, the tidal field sourced by the companion.
Because at infinity, it has to decay. Wherever you have the source of the gravitational field,
sorry?
The Bondi analysis.
That's not the real infinity.
What?
It's not the real infinity.
Yeah, at some point, so what's the mechanism that turns this growing field into a decaying field?
I mean, you can do different asymptotic expansions and match in the intermediate region. I mean, you can do it, it's just not necessary for these purposes.
It's the same equation, right?
There's no frequency. Yeah, and I'm ignoring the frequency here, which I'm going to care about when I start going past, you know, out of that into that region. So this is really focused on that neighborhood, and this will be a little bit more clear actually.
Yeah.
A little bit later, we'll go from the strict zero frequency limit to a limit where the frequency is small compared to the orbital, right? So
Because at infinity, yeah, that limit is singular. It's full of infrared divergence.
Yeah.
Become, okay.
Yeah. Okay, good. So, yes, we want to find the symmetry, which fixes that this fall off and this fall off have to be the same solution, the same solution interpolating between the two. So we take this this wave operator acting on phi, the static Klein-Gordon operator, and multiply it by a factor of minus delta. And we can call that a quote-unquote Hamiltonian. Okay, so this Klein-Gordon equation is just this. And what's nice about this quote-unquote Hamiltonian operator is that it admits raising and lowering operators, which are just these guys, in the sense that they have commutation relations with each other and with H, which tell you that if I act D plus L on a mode of angular momentum number L, then I'm going to get a solution to the equations with L plus 1, and similarly for the lowering operator. My lowering operator is going to solve the Klein-Gordon equation at one lower value of L. So these are operators to allow you to go between L values for static solutions. What we want to do is, this is a little bit unusual because it's taking a solution to one problem to a slightly different solution to a slightly different problem. What we want to do is find a symmetry that acts on solutions to the same wave operators or a single value of L. So the way we do that is it turns out that at the lowest value of L, so that'll be L equals 0 for the scalar or L equals S for a spin S field, there's actually an accidental symmetry related to the vanishing of this term, that there's a symmetry operator which commutes with the Hamiltonian, which is given by this guy here, Q0. So the L equals zero modes have this additional symmetry. And so to construct a symmetry for a mode with a non-trivial L, well, all you do is you use the lowering operators to lower it to the lowest rung, apply this Q0 translation, and then raise back up. And so for each individual value of L, you get a symmetry operator constructed recursively by lowering L times, applying this thing, and then raising the same number of times. Yeah, I wasn't sure what you called it. I've called it like a translation symmetry before. It's a symmetry which is only there for L equals zero, so it's accidental in that sense. It's not quite a translation symmetry, but
this reminds me when you apply a translation operator on a spherical symmetric solution, you can get higher more. Dan has used this in one of the papers from maybe that's related.
So the QL is as if I fix any L I want. So I have L equals 35, and I want to find a symmetry that takes an L equals 35 mode to another L equals 35 mode, for instance.
Q index L, sub-index L.
Good. This is the statement, right? So QL is a symmetry operator. In other words, if I act Q on a mode phi L, then that is a symmetry of the. So the other statement you would say is that QL commutes with this HL, basically.
And these DL, they form like an S4 algebra, it looks like S4.
So not quite, because their commutation relations have sort of different values of L, but there are SL2 algebras floating around, which I'll get to in. There are a bunch of them. So the point is that this Q0 is a symmetry operator for L equals zero, commutes with the Hamiltonian. And then by using these raising and lowering operators, we can get further symmetries for each L mode. And because those are symmetries of the action, it's straightforward to derive conserved charges, which are these PLs. And in fact, it's a very simple expression for the conserved charge. You add the lowering operators, and then that's it. So here's the story, just to simplify a bit. So we have the so-called vertical and horizontal ladder. So the vertical ladder operators, LDL plus DL minus, will raise and lower you in L value. And then by lowering all the way to the lowest rung and using that accidental symmetry, raising back up, you get this horizontal ladder that operates at any individual value of L. And that, in turn, comes with these conserved charges here. And that turns out to give you an explanation for the vanishing of the Love numbers, because if you evaluate this charge on the mode that's regular at the horizon, then you find the charge is zero. And if you have a mode that's diverging at the horizon, you get a non-zero charge. Then you go to infinity, and it turns out that a growing mode gives you non-zero charge, a zero charge. The decaying mode gives you a non-zero. So if I fix regularity at the horizon and then demand this charge be conserved, it's going to be zero at every value of R, and that's enough to pick out that there's no decaying term at infinity. Also, as an aside, kind of a cute thing is because we're motivated in part by the effective field theory approach, where you don't really know if there's a horizon, much less that there might be regularity there. All you know is that you're in some IR far away. The vanishing Love number modes preserve this symmetry, while the non-zero Love number solution would break it. So there's also a statement you could make. Symmetry statement you can make even without referencing regularity at the horizon in terms of symmetry break, which just tells you, right, that this is an enhanced symmetry point in the effective theory.
Technical question about the ladder. So if you go back to the ladder, what are the value of these objects from the people compute, or does it form an average of the D plus D minus Q?
Yeah, that's a good question. So like I said, I don't think the D pluses and D minuses form a straightforward algebra because they're commutation relations at different values of this subscript. So it's
D plus D minus Q, the entire ladder, is done from a symmetric algebra.
Yeah.
Let's keep that because at infinity we understand now there's something called Einstein algebra, which are infinity.
We have thought about whether this is related to the higher spin algebra and haven't found anything concrete. I think there's a paper by another group which did find some sort of Heisenberg algebra involving some subset of these. I don't remember what the exact, and they had some other operators in there. These ladder operators, this picture, I think it obscures the algebraic content of these symmetries a little bit. And actually, that's my...
Okay.
Ask me in like three slides if you still have questions, because I'll give you a better way to understand the algebra.
Yeah, I'm trying to maybe see it. So, my symmetry, I could imagine that I'm going to apply the same operator for some spherical. And I'm going to choose my boundary not to be the horizon. I can maybe be a 5.
Yeah.
Of course, I will need to put boundary conditions there, but that's not me. I could put boundary conditions. So why can I not replicate everything here? Now, when the boundary is like away from the liberalized or star, so what? Would I not then get much of what you're describing the same way?
So you would, but I don't think you would have a non-zero Love number in general, right? Because so. I'm setting boundary conditions at the surface of the star.
No, I didn't.
No, I'm not.
I'm going to put it where I want. It could be at the surface of the star. Be $90 away from the star.
Sure, I'm putting it somewhere that's not the horizon, right?
So unless you tell me I don't have all the freedom in the world whatever boundary conditions I want, but I could try and just fix the boundary conditions so as to make it whatever it has to be to match on.
So you'd have a boundary condition at wherever you set it that if I were to extrapolate it to the Schwarzschild radius,
right.
ignoring the fact that there's a star there, then it would not have any divergent piece, right?
Sure. Why would they have to do that?
You wouldn't have to.
But why would I have to do that? I'm only analyzing the subchunk of the space time that does not include the world.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to a solution that for all purposes is indistinguishable, which is that.
You can. I think they would be very, they would be tuned and they would not look like the natural boundary conditions to place
okay.
there.
Okay, so then this whole thing has a
right, cause,
strong requirement of that boundary conditions on how it
would happen. Well, when I have a black hole, I have a very strong boundary condition, which is that it has to be regular at the horizons. I have to have infallible boundary conditions.
Sure.
That's what fixes all of this. If I have a star, then, so that I have, you know, if I think of my two solutions as being the one that goes to a constant at the horizon and one that diverges, both of those modes, in principle, are going to be turned on
sure.
when I'm fixing boundary conditions at, you know, 10 kilometers or whatever. And so that's why you'll get a non-zero Love number. Now, these symmetry arguments absolutely should give you the Love number for that star in terms of the boundary conditions you're placing.
Right, when I'm getting confused, I could imagine, just to frame the thing, Israel, boundary conditions on a fictitious surface that is embedding and close to the star, and make that surface be whatever it is to be, so that you get exactly the same solutions as the black hole. You know, it's something weird about the boundary. So then, either something has broken wrong in the description, or I have to picture some actually really here, so as to not conclude that not numbers are zero. Because if I'm getting the exact same solution as in charging, I won't be able to tell you.
I think I'm missing something about your question, because I have okay. So I
the answer is in your next slide.
I'll go to the next slide and see if it helps. But
You're saying it's this guy is conserved, so PL is conserved. But is that what you're saying? If you change it manually, because you're conserved, I mean, that could be different.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you'll be able to calculate PL at wherever you put your boundary conditions.
So we imagine that's the case, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
If you use a solution and you compare different values, the charge is the same.
Yes. I mean, in the exterior, this charge will be conserved. The only difference is that because I'm not imposing this this regular at the horizon, then the charge is not necessarily going to be zero. It's going to be something involving the boundary conditions that I've set. And then that is going to be conserved, and I'm going to be able to read off a Love number from there as well. And I mean, Luis, it sounds like you're saying I could have some special boundary conditions to reproduce this zero Love number.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, I mean, you're allowed to... there's nothing wrong with that, so I don't. That's where I'm not understanding the question, because I don't think that those boundary conditions will be what you'll get from matching to the interior, right? Because it's very special too.
Sure.
But in principle, you could set them, and then you'd have no Love numbers, and
it is what it is.
Yeah, I mean, in that case, I think you really are putting funny boundary conditions, because this is what it's talking about, the extrapolation. Like, you'd be putting boundary conditions, which if you were to extrapolate them to the horizon, which is not really there, then it would be purely regular. But that's not like a physical criterion when you're talking about some kind of a star who's,
So your charge conservation is just to look at the statements on the second line, right? The charge conservation is just to derive that
the conclusion?
This solution, some form of the solution is regular as the other.
Yeah. So the idea is I have that calculation I did earlier, where if you solve the static Klein-Gordon equation in full generality, you see that it's one solution that's both regular at the horizon and growing. And now you can see that without solving the full equation, just by taking this conserved charge and looking at these two points. That's the idea of using symmetry to help you out.
Yeah, but not that difficult to solve that equation.
It's not. It's just a Legendre polynomial. It's okay, but then I go to the Reggie-Wheeler equation. Okay, now it's okay, geometric functions. I mean, at a certain point, even though the idea is to, even if you're able to put the equation in Mathematica and get the solution and look at what the, or if you're able to be clever and find the solution, having a symmetry explanation it helps. But yeah, I completely agree that you could see this conclusion just by solving the equation, but it's a little bit mysterious, nevertheless. Any other questions before I go to the next slide? So let me briefly talk about how this works for the more physical case. So gravitational perturbations on Kerr, described by the Tucholsky equation. In fact, this is for scalars, vectors, and gravitational perturbations for different values of S. So this is the same static equation I showed you before with a little more complication. To your question, I can solve this exactly, I think this is going to be in terms of hypergeometric functions, or maybe I don't want to. So this admits a ladder in L, and I could do the whole same story again. But in fact, there's a second and also kind of cute thing I can do, which is this admits spin raising and lowering operators. So if I act this E plus on a mode, it'll raise the spin, and then this operator will lower the spin. And these operators preserve the relevant boundary conditions for calculating Love numbers. So if I'm calculating the gravitational Love numbers, I can actually use these spin raising and lowering operators to convert it to a problem for the Klein-Gordon. And then the proof that I just showed you for Schwarzschild, but also you can do it for Kerr, would give you also vanishing gravitational Love numbers.
So by raising the spin,
What I mean is that I have a scalar solution, a solution to the spin zero equation. If I act this operator, I'll get a solution to the static spin one equation. So S equals one. So for the whatever the Maxwell scalar is. So if right from minus two to plus two, and this allows me to go, you might be familiar with the Tucholsky-Starobinsky identities, which let me go from minus two to plus two and vice versa. And there's similar ones for plus one and minus one. And in fact, these interpolate between those. So in the static regime, use these Tucholsky-Starobinsky identities to get extended a little bit to allow you to go in integer units of spin. By the way, you can also do the same L ladder for the Reggie-Wheeler equation. So if you're caring about gravitational dynamics on Schwarzschild, you can also apply the same logic.
Sorry, what about the spin 1/2?
Good. So I don't see any reason it shouldn't work. Personally, it's not super obvious to me what the physical setup is. Do I have some sort of fermionic static profile?
I'm just saying, because these are integer spins, so I'm just saying, is that a loophole in that?
So you still have the L ladder. You just wouldn't be able to connect these to a scalar or to bosonic modes. Yeah. Good. So maybe I won't go too deep into this, but in the point particle EFT, this symmetry argument does help you explain the vanishing of Love numbers also from the EFT point of view. So if I imagine, okay, so this is my ball kinetic term, this would be Einstein-Hilbert because the scalar standing in for gravity. Got the usual point particle action. And then I could have a hair term and a bunch of Love number terms involving these symmetrized traceless derivatives, which are like the electric and magnetic Weyl tensor components. And there is the symmetry that I showed you, you can actually write in the flat space limit in the following sense. And you can see that you can see sort of straightforwardly that the only term involving the scalar that's invariant under this is just the bulk kinetic term. So this is a symmetry which deals with that naturalness issue, EFT point of view. We talk a little bit about a geometric interpretation of where these symmetries come from. So let's say the pure static scalar field, right? So here's my action, right? Phi box phi, and I've got no time derivatives. And you can do something really interesting. So you can perform a conformal transformation where the conformal factor is 1/√δ. There's an arbitrary scale for reasons dimensions. And in terms of this new metric and this conformally transformed scalar, you end up with a mass term that is constant. And so there's it's a massive field on this G tilde background. And what is this G tilde? It's actually nothing other than Euclidean ADS3. So what this shows is that a static massless scalar on a Schwarzschild background has the same dynamics as a massive scalar on Euclidean ADS3, with this value of the mass. The reason I was emphasizing the fact that this is a constant, because normally if I'm doing R-dependent transformations like this, I should expect to get some function of R in front of this. But because it's constant, that means that the killing vectors of the ADS3 are going to generate isometries of the scalar field. So those will be conformal killing vectors of this of the 3D part of Schwarzschild. And it turns out that those killing isometries, so I've written one of them down here. It's the one I showed a couple slides back too. So this is one of the ADS3 killing vectors. This is how it affects a scalar field. And what happens is if I have this symmetry operator act on a single multipole, then what it spits out is the raising operator and the lowering operator acting on modes one higher and one lower. So this sort of geometric perspective describing the static dynamics in terms of dynamics on a Euclidean ADS tells us right away that there are killing vectors, and one of those killing vectors precisely gives us our raising and lowering operators.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I didn't understand your discussion about relating the backgrounds. I mean, okay, you have done a perfect conformal transformation of the space part of your metric, but why is that a symmetry? Why should you say that the two situations that you have, namely Euclidean ADS3 with massive and just flat without with massless, are the same? Is that a symmetry?
This is just a field redefinition at this point. So this is a change of variables. So these are equivalent, right? Because it's not about a symmetry; it's just about a change of variables. And the point is that because this here is diff invariant, right, in terms of 3D diffs, because there's no function of R here, then the killing vectors of the ADS3 are going to be symmetries. All I have to do is go through these redefinitions to work out what those isometries look like in terms of the original scalar.
Yeah.
No worries. Good, so that's the static case. And let me go straight to a case where you can do something very similar, but leaving in something to do with the frequency. And I think this will hopefully answer some of your questions about, right? So let's keep the frequency now. So here's the full Klein-Gordon equation on Schwarzschild. And we want to assume that the frequencies are small, right? The idea is that there's a binary black hole, say, or neutron stars or whatever, and they're moving really slowly with respect to each other during the in-spiral phase. And so the frequencies set by the orbital frequencies are going to be very small compared to the Schwarzschild radius and also compared to or to one over the Schwarzschild, and also compared to where you are. So this defines the so-called near zone region, where I consider distances that are outside the horizon and much smaller than 1 over omega. So 1 over omega, I'm imagining, is sort of like the orbit, right, of the binary. If I stay well within that, but I still have a small frequency, then I'm going to include both the near horizon and sort of asymptotically flat region, which I was calling infinity.
That's where we cannot go. That's the point. You can go to infinity that way, right? Because you have an expression in 1 over omega.
Oh, infinity is 1 over omega.
So you have the intermediate region, but you cannot access the boundary you know, the usual assumption to be flat with you.
So there.
Where the 1/r expansion is you can define the 1/r expansion.
Yeah.
Because so, 1/r expansion is really the 1/r expansion.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But you have a sense of asymptotic flatness, even, you know, where it ends infinity, I'm imagining now it's 1/(Omega). But yeah.
But if it's 1/(Omega), it's very big. So you cannot trust the 1/(r) expansion. Right? 1/(Omega)r is much bigger than 1. That's what I'm saying.
Sorry.
You're saying that 1/(Omega)r.
Yes.
Omega R,
yeah, is yeah, big. Yeah.
So you cannot trust. So you.
Let me walk through and we'll see if you have
okay.
Right. So we want to do something really simple, which is to take this term here and expand it in this near zone region, and you know, as a region we can work with it, right? You can expand out this term here as follows, right? You can expand it all out here, and you can see that the only term here which doesn't vanish, basically, in this limit, is going to be this final term, because there is a 1/(r-rs) in there. So what we do, imagine we just chopped out all of these terms, they're clearly subdominant, only catch this one, and now we plug this back up into here. So this r to the fourth turns into an rs to the fourth. This is, you can think of this as mapping the Klein-Gordon equation in this near zone region to a related equation that overlaps in the regime of validity. And something really interesting happens, which is that, so here's the near zone Klein-Gordon equation. I replaced this r to the fourth, rs to the fourth. And similar to before, we want to find an effective metric in the sense that we want to find the metric whose box operator gives you precisely this differential operator. And so it's pretty simple to find that metric. It looks like this. So for comparison, the original Schwarzschild metric is what I would have if I replaced all of these RSs with Rs. So it's related, it's sort of similar, but a little bit different. The Schwarzschild. And it's actually much more symmetric than Schwarzschild, because it's really nothing other than ADS2 cross S2. So you have this ADS, but instead of Euclidean 3D ADS, it's a 2D Lorentzian ADS across the two-sphere. And this metric possesses an incredibly rich symmetry structure. Before I go to explain what that symmetry structure is, I'll point out that the same thing applies to Kerr. So for Kerr, there's more ambiguity as to what you call the near zone. But for a suitable choice, you actually end up with a geometry that's equivalent to this after a coordinate redefinition.
Sorry, every Kerr or just X comma Kerr?
Sorry?
Every Kerr or just X comma Kerr?
Every Kerr.
It's what? It is 2 times S2 in the near horizon.
It depends how you take this near horizon limit.
Oh, there is a limit that gives you the S2 time, but it must be like the leading, it must be near X comma.
No. It's any value of the spin. So there was this bunch of work like 10 years ago when it was the Kerr CFT duality type stuff that people were looking at different near zones, and there's a whole family of different near zone approximations you can make that are all kind of equally kosher. And there's one particular one that admits this nice geometric formulation. And so for that choice, that's
near zone.
Yeah, I said near horizon just now, and I messed that up. It's a particular near zone approximation for Kerr, which admits this nice geometric story. And it's not the only one. So there's there are other papers dealing with symmetries and love numbers that actually use different near zones for Kerr.
Can you go back one slide?
Yeah.
Okay, so the claim is R could be RS, like your Schwarzschild region.
Yeah, so here this is for Schwarzschild.
Right. So R can be larger than Schwarzschild radius.
Yes, it has to be.
And then that formula you're saying approximately will be just well RS force divided by delta. That's near right. That's near right. That's not near delta.
Yeah.
So I am taking both near, I'm not assuming anywhere that R is near RS. All I'm asking is that omega be small.
Yeah, compared
to,
for example, R equals 2 RS.
Yep.
Separate by, perfect by your near zone.
Yeah.
And then what that is, then this omega squared alpha 4 divided delta is 16 times the expression right on the right hand side, right? It's not a positive diagonal.
So,
the ratio of the two,
yeah.
Right? So, if you take the ratio of the two, you're saying
yeah.
R over RS is approximately one.
Yeah.
The factor of omega squared is.
It doesn't matter for this approximation.
I mean, less than that, omega squared cancels, delta cancels, just as R approximately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. If I think about the difference between those, not the ratio, think about the difference between those, the difference, because it's multiplied by omega squared, is still going to be small, is the idea.
The difference
yeah.
is the same as its magnitude. If R is 2 times RS, then the left-hand side is right, 16 times bigger than the right-hand side. So they're not possible to say.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. If you take a difference, then it's going to be.
Actually, the question is all homogeneous in omega squared. So you're doing an R toward R limit when you do this assumption.
But they're not just cancel out, but they're not taking R goes to RS limit. So near as R is greater than S, R is smaller than the.
Yeah, so the idea is the following, right? So you want to take, so here's the original Klein-Gordon, static Klein-Gordon, not static Klein-Gordon, the original Klein-Gordon. And then here's the near zone, Klein-Gordon. The idea is that you want to have that the solutions to one or the solutions to the other are very close when both of these factors are small. So that's what you're going to have.
Here the condition of omega, but it's not obvious because your identity is homogeneous in omega.
Yeah.
So I mean, maybe whatever. What you're doing is you're replacing this by another equation. What is the relative validity of the approximation? Okay.
Yeah.
I think that's
so,
what you were asking. Whether the validity of that approximation really depends on omega, as you're saying.
Yeah.
Right? It's not obvious from this analysis, but I guess if you compare numerically.
Yeah.
It's not clear.
You're gonna.
Small omega.
So you're going to differ by terms that look like omega squared RS squared. But those terms are small. And so as I move away from the horizon, this sort of error is going to grow, right, due to that mismatch, but it's still going to be overall small as long as you're within this region. So that's the idea. Any other questions or... Good. So this is an ADS2 cross S2, this metric. So here's the metric again. And here are some of its nice properties. So it's conformally flat, the Weyl tensor vanishes, which means that it has the maximal number of conformal Killing vectors in 4D, that's 15. They organize themselves into 6 Killing vectors and 9 conformal Killing vectors. And moreover, the Ricci scalar vanishes. So the Ricci tensor is non-zero. These aren't Ricci flat solution metrics, not solutions, not equations, really. But because the Ricci scalar vanishes, the conformally coupled value of the mass, which is proportional to the Ricci scalar, is just zero. So a massless scalar is automatically conformally coupled. And so the conformal isometries of this metric necessarily will all generate symmetries for the massless scalar. So I didn't want to type them all out, but I figured I should show you what these look like. So here are your 15 conformal killing vector and killing vectors. You have your usual time and angular isometries. And then this conformal killing vector, J01, is the one that's relevant for Love numbers. And you can see actually it's one of the few that doesn't, that is independent of time. So a lot of them have these e to the t factors. But this one here doesn't depend on time. And so it's going to take a static solution to another static, or a small omega to another small omega solution. So that's the one we really care about. And when you act this on a single multipole, then again, it gets you our ladder operators. And I promised you a discussion of the algebra. So before I go past the slide, let me say, so there's 15 of them. They form an SO42 algebra. And there are several SL2R subalgebras. And they're formed by taking this time-like killing vector, T, with each of these pairs, L plus minus, K plus minus, M and N, plus or minus. These are complicated, but you can check that all of these are isometries and all of them form the those subalgebras. I appear to be out of time, which is good because I just finished talking about Love numbers, so I can skip the duality stuff. But are there any other questions on the Love numbers before I move on? Yeah.
I have a question about the previous slide when you said I just missed the reasoning. So when you say conformal that, what did you mean by 6 killing vectors and 9? Is that the amount you can find, or is that the maximal amount?
15. So 9 plus 6 is 15.
Ah, 9 plus 6 is not that. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So 9. Yeah. So 6 killing, and 9 only conformal killing.
Oh. Yeah. That's what you're saying there. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I missed. Thanks. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a ton of symmetry, and we only need one of those conformal killing vectors. Luis, I know we started a couple of minutes late, but it's 2:00. Should I wrap up? Oh, you're the chair. Sorry, Juan. Should I wrap up? 5 minutes, sure. Sounds good. So I will briefly discuss the duality story. I can probably skip the black hole perturbation theory primer for this audience, okay? You know, say we're doing metric perturbations around Schwarzschild, H mu nu around the background. We can split them into even and odd parity modes that correlate to the plus cross polarizations. And then we can further split them in angular and in spherical harmonics. And both the even and the odd sectors obey Schrodinger-like equations, formulated in terms of the Reggie-Wheeler and Zirilli master variables, with these V plus minus potentials, which have following complicated forms. So you have your Reggie-Wheeler potential and your Zirilli potential. The Reggie-Wheeler potential for the odd modes is really simple. The Zirilli potential is a pain in the butt for the even modes. But what Chandrasekhar found in the 80s is that both of these can be derived from a single function W of R, which they called superpotential, an analogy to supersymmetric quantum mechanics, which has basically the same structure. So both the even and the odd dynamics, which are decoupled from each other, have this sort of secret link. And that secret link between them, in turn, directly leads to the both sectors having the same quasi-normal mode spectrum. So to study this in terms of off-shell action symmetries, you want to study symmetries of the action to calculate near their currents. And there's a kind of standard procedure to calculate the dynamics at the level of the action, which is you fix a gauge. So you have, H mu nu has 10 degrees of freedom, 10 components, right? 7 in the even sector, 3 in the odd. I fix a gauge that gets rid of 4 of them. 4 more of them are non-dynamical. They're auxiliary fields. They don't have time derivatives. And so you can integrate out those fields. You're left with the 2 dynamical degrees of freedom, and they'll be in some messy form. And so you can only normalize by rescaling the field, rescaling the coordinates. And at the end of the day, it turns out that the coordinate rescaling is just to the usual tortoise coordinate, and then the canonically normalized fields are just the Reggie-Wheeler and Cyrillian vector variables. So they emerge in this nice kind of dynamical approach, and the action, the Einstein-Hilbert action, takes, I mean, precisely the form you would have expected from looking at the Reggie-Wheeler and Cyrillian equations, but it's nice to be able to derive that from the Einstein-Hilbert action. And if you replace V plus minus with this superpotential, so the action now looks like this, it's manifestly invariant under these Chandrasekhar transformations here. Except that now, instead of this being a symmetry at the level of the equations of motion, it's a symmetry of the action. And so you can also write in terms of the metric perturbations, you can calculate conserved charges. For the tidal responses, for example, if you calculate the conserved charge, it looks like this in terms of the even and odd modes. If I acquire both modes to be regular at the horizon, it tells me that this has to be zero. And then at infinity, if I calculate this, it turns out that it's proportional to the difference between the even and odd Love numbers. And so setting this to zero implies that the Love numbers have to be equal to each other in the even and odd sectors. So I mentioned earlier these ladder symmetries. You could tell this ladder story for the Reggie-Wheeler equation, but not for the Cyrillian equation. So this duality will actually help you to show that the even sector Love number has to vanish too. And one final slide, just to understand where this comes from. If you look at the flat space limit of this symmetry, it just becomes an SO2 duality, which is... it's basically just the standard gravitational electric magnetic duality that rotates the Riemann tensor into its dual and vice versa. So that's interesting because a linearized EM duality has been shown to be a symmetry around Minkowski, ADS, and DS. And so you see it also extends to Schwarzschild, probably also to Kerr, and it raises the question of how far that goes. I think I've reached my 5 minutes and I've reached my summary slide. So, yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
Maybe we can ask you to comment on this solution in your five dimensions. Vanish is no longer here. What piano, what analysis, what insight?
Yeah. So for the Love number story, the duality story, I don't know if there's any remnant in that. But that's also similar to higher dimensions where like EM duality you don't have because of just, you know, different numbers of indices on F and F dual, right? For the Love numbers, it's actually been shown, not originally by us, but also by us, that in higher dimensions, the Love numbers vanish when L over D minus 3, D is the number of dimensions, when this is an integer, the Love numbers vanish. So in four dimensions, this is the same as L, and so it vanishes for every L. In 5D, the Love numbers vanish for every other L. In 6D, they vanish for every third L, and so on. And those you can explain in terms of the exact same story. The ladder operators exist, but instead of changing you to L plus one, they add one to this quantity here. So if you remember, we constructed this horizontal symmetry by using lowering operators to get to the lowest value of L. So L equals zero for a scalar, L equals two for gravity, and then using the symmetry there. If this thing is integer, which is the values where the Love number vanishes, then you're able to lower. Then the lowering operator will get you to the lowest L. But if this is half integer, and I'm lowering in integer steps of this thing, then you're not going to be able to connect to that lowest thing and construct this horizontal symmetry.
Some internal structure of an object that is absolutely dark, hopefully comparable to the same star. That story doesn't seem to work anymore in some sense. Yeah, you see what I'm saying? It's trying to get a physical story behind that map.
Yeah, it's a it's a good question. Is there are there nicer physics words I could wrap around this? And I'm not sure, to be honest. Because you also have, like I said, you have vanishing love numbers for certain L values in higher dimensions, and I don't really know of good physical reasons why that should be. I think it's a thing you find, and it's a thing that we have a symmetry story for. But I'll have to think about a good physical story for that.
So, Neil, do you have a question?
The near horizon metric that you introduced. So you found this ADS to metric that approximates the first metric close to the horizon. But you know, I'm free to perform a diffeomorphism, which preserves the horizon but is not away from the horizon. And would also be another ADS to metric that is a near horizon metric, which approaches the Schwarzschild metric in the near horizon region. So you found one such metric, but the question is it unique? And if it's not unique, then all of them will have different generators of symmetry and so on. So it's very similar to the story at null infinity.
So I'm not sure I understand the question, because you're right that I can, it's unique up to diffeomorphisms, but is that what you're, I also don't know where to look.
what I mean is like this, the story is very, sounds very similar to null infinity, where at null infinity, you can, the metric approaches the Minkowski metric.
Yeah.
And so you might think, so you found a Minkowski metric, you found a Poincaré group. But it's not a symmetry group, but not infinity. And the reason is that, you know, there's not one Minkowski metric that approaches the, there's many different Minkowski metrics that you can find, which are infinity metrics, flat metrics that you can approximate the metric. And if you combine all of the Poincaré groups of those Minkowski, you get the BMS group, and that's the asymptotic symmetry group there. So I feel like there's something similar that might be going on here, which is because you found one ADS type metric, which is a new horizon metric, but you know, I could find another one.
Yeah, so okay, so there's a couple of questions. I think one is you know, there's sort of an open question whether any of these symmetries have any relation to the BMS story, because there's a similar flavor, right? In terms of, you're talking about symmetries at, you know, at singular points of your dynamics. And okay, this I don't know. So I guess you're saying once I have this near zone metric, I guess you're suggesting that there might be a family of such equivalent that are sort of in a BMS-like way. I mean, maybe, I don't know. As if that's what the question was. I mean, in general, it would be, I think, really interesting to understand if the BMS story has any relevance to this. Something I've been wondering for a few years now, but I...
just meant it as an analogy, not a mathematical.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's...
Okay, and yeah. Oh, if not, let's